When all is ready, I throw this switch.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Collected Edition comic book podcast, where we discuss the famous and infamous runs and story arcs throughout the history of comics. I'm Paul Matthew Carr, and with me, as always, is Brian Reese.
That's me. I'm Brian Reese.
Yes, you are, Brian Reese.
I'm glad to be here.
Excellent. I'm glad you're here, too. Because if you weren't here, I'd be talking to myself.
It would be a lonely, lonely, lonely hour and a half.
It would be. Now, today on the program, all you mother-loving jokers out there, get ready for Luke Cage Power Man.
Sweet Christmas!
Sweet Christmas. So, specifically, the Masterworks Edition Volume 2, written and drawn by so many people. But we'll get into that later. But first, before we get into that, a few things have happened in the world of comics. The good, the bad, and the ugly. And let's start with the ugly.
Mostly the ugly.
Yeah. By the time this comes out, everyone will have weighed in their opinions on this, but it would be remiss of us not to mention it. And that is the fact that James Gunn has been fired by the Disney Corporation because of some very old and very admittedly offensive tweets were unearthed by an alt-right asshole. I'm sorry, concerned citizen.
Yeah.
I obviously have my thoughts on this. Brian?
You have feelings.
I do. So, what did you think when you heard this particular bit of news?
Just in case you try to edit out your own, I'm going to make it more difficult for you. Yes, this was released by an alt-right asshole.
Indeed.
Between the two of us, one of us will get that in there. I think I. Man, it's tricky, isn't it? I mean, it's
well, no,
nothing's easy. I mean, you know, we can.
Well, no, here are my feelings.
That's kind of how I.
Yeah, if you actually look at the tweets, they are indefensible. I mean, they're awful. And you could say that they're jokes. Well, they're not funny jokes. They're awful things. But the thing about that is, he's already acknowledged that they're terrible years ago. He's come out. He's had his mea culpa. He's already done, you know, the work of trying to make up for those bad things he said. They're terrible jokes. But, you know, firing someone because they got trolled just sets a really bad precedent that I'm afraid will come back to haunt Disney.
Well, sure. I mean, this is the world we live in. And unfortunately, we live in a Twitter world or a podcast world where anything you or I say could be used against us 20 years from now.
No, I'm always upright. I never say anything I don't mean.
No, not at all. So we do live in a problematic world where everything that we have said or posted or done in the past has now been recorded for posterity. At the same time, that's a little problematic in that, yes, what I thought 20 years ago or whatever stupid shit I said 20 years ago probably, hopefully, does not reflect who I am now as an individual.
Oh, absolutely not. Oh, my God. But, oh, my yeah. God. Some of the things, the person I was 20 years ago is not.
We've all been.
We're different. You grow up. You change. You're.
We grow up. We change, and we also learn more about the world around us, and we learn more about the people around us, and we learn more about how what we say affects other people that we care about, or even those that we don't care about that we come in contact in our social or daily lives. Now, you and I have the advantage of not being celebrities yet.
Well, we are in our own little world.
Right. So there are less people who care what I said 20 years ago and what I said 20 minutes ago.
Well, we had the benefit of not having Twitter and Facebook, you know, that type of social media of recording everything we do. But regardless,
I have been an ignorant man in my past, yeah, or an ignorant lad.
Yeah. Well, regardless of that,
that's my superheroes character, ignorant lad.
That's awesome. But
the thing is,
someone who's already, you know, that Disney went through their due diligence. They saw those tweets before they hired the guy. I find it really hard to believe that this comes as a surprise.
Right. Somebody has.
Yeah. It was just a knee-jerk reaction. This came down really, really quickly. You know, so it seems to me as if this was a boardroom decision, not a decision by the Marvel creative family, obviously.
Yeah,
because this has far-reaching ramifications for the Marvel Cinematic Universe. I mean, he was supposed to usher in the cosmic side of things for the next phase. It was his vision, or at least his.
Sure.
His ideas
he was going to be the showrunner, if not just the director, but sort of the showrunner or the overseer.
Right.
Yeah.
The kind of like what Joss Whedon was a few years ago, you know, when getting the Avengers started in the first phase.
Right.
But aside from that, the thing that really bothers me is the fact that this is out there. It's already been acknowledged. It's already been addressed. And just to have it dredged up again. He's already said he's sorry. He's already admitted fault. But it comes up again just because of his political affiliation. And that's it, because he's been a vocal, outspoken person against President Trump. And it's because of that that all this was dredged up again.
Well, and I think that's...
has nothing to do with...
Because I think that there are two parts of the story. There is the gentleman, and I use that term lightly, what is it, Cernovich, it's the Pizzagate guy.
Yeah.
So this is the guy he's going after, anybody who is vocally anti-Trump who happens to be a celebrity. And you know, he's basically said he's going after all of them and dredging up whatever dirt he can find on them, apparently even dredging up the stuff that's not really controversial, but casting it into
Right.
A out of context and into a light that's different than what comments have been intended. You mentioned Patton Oswalt. We were talking earlier before this, who has also been targeted by this guy.
Right.
So that's one issue. But the other issue is that James Gunn did say these things. And to be honest, he said them 10 years ago, which puts him at about 41 years old. Now, we are talking about not wanting to be held to what we said 20 years ago when we were in our 20s. Well, to be honest, James Gunn was in his 40s.
Yeah,
he said these things. And so I get that he was trying to be funny, but you know, it's not like he was some, you know,
no, but it was
saying something stupid when they're like, you know, smoked a bong,
yeah,
you know, and they're 23 and everything is hilarious.
He was trying to cultivate the Howard Stern mentality, you know, to be controversial for controversial sake. I mean, it was a conscious decision. It was a stupid decision. And the things that he said, they weren't funny, like I said, and they're inexcusable. But I guess they're inexcusable, but I'm going to excuse him right here.
You know? Well, and the question is, are they inexcusable?
Yeah. Well,
and where do you draw the line? I think that we sometimes have to be careful about the pitchforks, and I think that folks are often willing to bring out the pitchforks when it suits their needs, but will conveniently put their pitchforks away when it doesn't suit their needs. I'm not saying you or I are doing that, but I think there is a little bit of that, and I think we have to be careful. This is in defense of James Gunn. I think that, first of all, I'm a free speech kind of guy. I know First Amendment is recourse from the government. It is no business is required to retain an employee because of what they say, as long as the government isn't actively attempting to keep that employee from having said job or what have you. But at the same time, it's I think one of the other issues is like to automatically say that James Gunn was wrong in what he was posting is a whole nother issue. And I'm not ready to completely condemn James Gunn for his jokes. I can condemn him for it being a bad joke, but I'm not necessarily willing to condemn him for it being indefensible. Now this could get us a whole bunch of angry responses. The world of comedy, we talked about this earlier, but you know, people need to watch The Aristocrats, the movie The Aristocrats, if they really want to get their underpants all in a bunch, and they really want to condemn a whole slew of revered comedians for inappropriate jokes. Whether they're funny or not has nothing to do with the fact that they are or are not an attempt at jokes.
Right. I'm reluctant to say that certain subjects are off the table as far as humor is concerned. But if you're going to, you know, if it's going to be rape or pedophilia, that joke better be really, really freaking funny. Because if it's not,
it better be Bill Hicks level.
Yeah. Yeah. And because if it's not, then you just come off sounding like James Gunn did, which is, you know, immature and puerile.
But he was 41 years old. Give or take.
But no, I'm more concerned with the fact that someone can be attacked, politically attacked, and their employer just doesn't have their back. That has bad ramifications for the future. Not just James Gunn. He's a rich white guy in Hollywood. I think he'll be fine.
But
it's the idea. Yeah, it's the precedent that's being set, and that's what I find most offensive. I'm sorry.
Oh, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, I'm not being very articulate about this, but there are people, and I recommend going and watching Bob Chipman or Lindsay Ellis. Both have pieces on this, and they are much more articulate and have much stronger voices than I do. But they sum up this controversy really, really well, and give you a better idea why this is a wrong thing to do.
The purposes are here is there's concern about what does that mean for the Marvel Universe going forward too, to take it into a non-political.
Yeah, as far as just, you know, me being selfish and wanting good entertainment, it would have been great to have a nice, you know, Guardians trilogy and then getting into the more cosmic side of things. So
but we might still have that. I mean,
it's still going to happen.
James Gunn is not the only director in town. He's not the only person, you know.
No, but he obviously had a vision. He had something that was new and unique and different, and obviously had a love for the material.
There's plenty of other creative individuals out there, directors.
No, I'm pretty sure he was it.
Yeah, writers or whatever, who might also, like she or he may have great ideas as well. And, you know, perhaps James Gunn is no longer going to be behind these films, but so now
I'm afraid that
an opportunity exists for another individual, another person to be able to walk into the room and say, I've got this great idea.
I'm just afraid that these alt-right mother-loving jokers are going to go after more and more people, and they already have.
Sure.
And they'll
continue to.
So just a line needs to be drawn in the sand and say, no, you can't do this. Just stop. That's apparently not the world we live in right now.
Well, I mean, at some point, you know, people are going to put their feet down. Yeah. And
finally, Republicans are want gun control, and this is what happens.
I see what you did there.
I did. All right. So let's move on to something more fun. Funner.
Because comics are fun.
Yes. So a lot of stuff came out of San Diego Comic-Con last week at the time of this recording. But we're going to focus on one thing that I really think it was my favorite thing to come out of Comic-Con, and that is the Shazam trailer, which, Brian, I made you watch just recently.
Yes, Mere minutes ago, I believe.
I think this is just wonderfully silly and fun, and just something that is a refreshing change for the DCEU. They're not calling it that anymore.
The grim and gritty DCEU.
It's the DC universe now, isn't it?
Or whatever, yeah, whatever they're currently calling it. Whoever's in charge right now, they keep moving people around, so I can't. It's hard to keep up with who is now in charge of the films.
Yes, but as far as Shazam is concerned, I mean, he's a goofy character to begin with, and
Captain Marvel.
It's Shazam now. Captain Marvel's somebody completely different.
I know, but that's a whole podcast in and of itself, isn't it? I'm sure there are people who have covered the whole Captain Marvel lawsuit and all of that, kerfuffle. Yeah.
You can't spite Marvel when DC let the copyright lapse. Like, right. Oh yeah, I'll take that name. Thank you very much.
Shazam, the artist formerly known as Captain Marvel.
Exactly.
Wait, no, Captain. Yes, no, I got that right. Okay.
Yeah. So here's the thing though. He has to say Shazam in order to change.
Right.
So he can never say his name. What? Sure. You know, someone says, "Who are you?" Shazam. Damn.
Well, is there? What I wonder is there a decibel level in which the change occurs?
So,
like if he just says Shazam in a normal, you know, talking voice.
Yes, but if he goes to Gomer Pyle levels, then
right,
Shazam, you know,
Shazam, surprise, surprise, surprise.
And to all the young kids out there. Gomer Pyle was a TV show from a long time ago.
This podcast is lovingly dedicated to the memory of Jim Nabors.
I got to put a Jim Nabors song now at the end.
You do, I know. I mean, you'd think someone should have to address that, because you're right. I mean, if he just says Shazam.
Yeah. Actually, now that I think about it, is it Kingdom Come where he can move faster than the lightning bolt?
Right, yeah.
So he says Shazam and then jumps out of the way. Yeah, because he fights Superman with that.
Yes.
And Superman's vulnerable to magic. Anyway, it's all very silly, and this looks great, because, you know, I love the idea that Billy Batson's a kid, and when he turns into a superhero, he turns into what a kid thinks a superhero should be. And that's just wonderfully fantastic. So I'm glad they didn't take the grim and gritty serious route with this.
Right. I mean, it looks very, there's a lot of jokes.
Yeah. Well, it is. It's Geoff Johns.
Right.
It looks almost exactly like the new 52 run.
And Shazam himself kind of looks a little bit like Jimmy Fallon. Go back. Keep that in your next time you watch. Go back.
And I don't want that in my mind. Oh,
keep that in your mind now. And next time you see the trailer, just think Jimmy Fallon, Jimmy Fallon, Jimmy Fallon.
Oh no! Why do you have to?
You're welcome.
We can't have nice things, Brian. Why? Well, I'm really excited about having a fun DC film being made, and maybe, just maybe, that'll rub off on some of the other franchises. Well, Wonder Woman's already doing that. Wonder Woman's going to have a nice 80s thing going on.
And you know, the last Wonder Woman had its moments of levity.
Yes.
Somewhere. I think.
No, absolutely it did.
Yeah. Yeah. Right, and Batman v Superman was hilarious. I mean, it was a pretty hilarious movie, am I right?
I was laughing when Martha came up.
Yeah. I understand that maybe it wasn't intended to be hilarious, but it was hilarious.
Yeah. Yep. That is the funniest Lex Luthor I've ever seen.
That's such a bad Lex Luthor. But I think Shazam should be interesting. It looks a little buddy cop kind of.
That's exactly what it's supposed to be.
Yeah. I'm not in the market for another buddy cop movie.
Did you read any of the New 52? New 52 Shazam, I should say. No?
Which New 52 Shazam?
The Geoff Johns written Shazam stories. They were sort of a backup in Justice League, and then they were collected into one big trade.
Oh, yeah. No, no, I remember. I wasn't following Justice League because the writers and the artists were so bad on it that I
wasn't either. I picked up the trade of the collected Shazam stories just to read it. And it's fun.
You're right. And I remember reading that there was some Shazam stuff, but I was like, if it's by the same creative team, I'm back on the Justice League tip right for now. But for the last 3 or 4 years, I've been like, it seemed like such a hot mess that I was like, I can't do this.
Yeah. Well, yeah, you know, it's a fun story. It looks like it's pulling heavily. This movie is pulling heavily from that. And it's, you know, it's Geoff Johns. It's your favorite. It's your buddy.
My buddy is Geoff Johns.
Yeah. You're always
there. My buddy right now is Brian Michael Bendis.
That's amazing.
His Superman is great.
I know, isn't it?
It is.
It really is. He's found some new creative life.
I think so. I mean, yeah. So, you know, when I say Bendis, I mean Bendis.
Woohoo.
But Geoff Johns, I like Geoff Johns all right. He's a good writer. I mean, he loves comics, and he's done some very good things for DC. Yeah. But he's not my guy. I don't know. Warren Ellis is probably my guy. I don't know if I had a guy. Maybe Jonathan Hickman, Kelly Sue DeConnick.
I'm just going to let you keep going and just name everybody.
I'll just name everybody that I like.
Yeah. Okay. Rick Remender. I'm going to have here's my list from 1 to 1,000. No, I'm very excited for a nice, happy, colorful DC story. And hopefully we can get a Superman story that's colorful and happy. I'm thinking it'll be fun.
Okay. All right.
So, do you want to talk about Batman yet? Or should we let it simmer?
I don't know. What are we going to add about Batman? I mean, my simple take on Batman is...
Well, you left it last week with Batman was ruined forever, so...
Did I really say ruined forever?
Yes.
That's excellent that I said that. That might have been a slight bit of hyperbole. But all joking aside, so a little bit of hyperbole. But I think they had an opportunity to do something really interesting. And they've teased for a long time. Instead of doing something interesting with the character, which is to marry him off, and then approach the character from a different standpoint, instead they were like, oh, well, we can't approach the character from a different standpoint because, as we found out in the issues coming up to that, when Joker was talking to Selina Kyle, you know, oh, Batman won't be Batman if he gets married. And so, boom. Oh, well, yeah, we can't have that because we want to just have the same Batman that we've had for the past.
Do you think that was Tom King's decision, or do you think that was a mandate from on high?
I think Tom King has had pretty much free reign with what he's done with Batman. So I think that was Tom King's decision.
Okay. Well, we had talked about this once before on the podcast where we thought that this would be a really great new direction and something different.
Yeah.
But
have somebody honestly, else take over for good.
Yeah. I did not think that was going to happen, actually. I thought it would be cool if it did, but I kind of knew that that was going to be the case.
Yeah, and there were numerous folks who had posted elsewhere, you know, showing all the evidence that they weren't going to get married.
Yeah, and even before the New York Times article,
right?
Once it was announced that there was going to be a Catwoman ongoing, it's like, oh well, obviously, it's not going to happen.
Yeah, and if you read the descriptions for the Catwoman comics, you know, it was basically that told you right there that they weren't going to get married. But I'm like, why tease? I feel like it was such a cash grab. And, you know, they did those specials leading into it as well, which I thought was really, really cheapened the whole thing then by not going through with it. It just seems like them not getting married was more a generic trope than them getting married, which I think would have been a braver decision for DC Comics to do, which is weird that I'm advocating, you know, a traditional union as the braver choice than conversely
Well, there is one part of that story that I thought was brilliant, and it was just the one page of Bruce talking to Alfred.
Right.
And yeah, there was that one page where he said, you know, should I get Mr. Kent or I forget. So who's going to be your best man? And he says, it's you. You know, that was such a lovely moment. Well drawn, well written, perfect. Worth the price of admission right there.
Yeah.
To me.
I mean, there's nice things in it, but at the end of the day, it was a cop-out.
Yeah. I didn't really care for the pin-ups with the curly font every other page. You know, I wish it was just a straightforward story, but they were going for collector's item.
Fine. Well, and they had to, like, fill in some pages to justify the price point.
But in the end, I don't think it ruined Batman Forever.
No, but it just... It
you know returned. What ruined Batman Forever? Val Kilmer.
Yeah. Oh, I see. Well done, Mr. Carr.
Thank you very much. But, you know, I still think Tom King's the best writer in comics today.
Really?
Yeah. I love everything he's doing right now.
I think he's a very good writer. Certainly one of the best writers. It would be hard for me to say who is the best writer in comics. Cause
okay, I'll change that.
People were writing different things, and you know.
I will alter my statement. He's my favorite writer in comics.
Yeah. Okay.
There you go. Sorry, I'll qualify my statements from now on. Brian,
Paul,
let's take a break and come back with some 70s blaxploitation.
That sounds fantastic.
He has been challenged to read all the comics he has collected. This podcast will summarize, review, and reminisce about a single comic book issue and the time period somewhat chronologically by release date. He keeps a stack of comics near his bedside for when the time is right. Who is this interesting comic fan and what is the podcast? Hello, my name is Pat. I don't normally do podcasts about the comic books I read, but when I do, I podcast about them on The Longbox Crusade. Listen to it on iTunes, Stitcher, or on thelongboxcrusade.com, and check out the Facebook page. Read them all, my friends.
And we're back!
Back in the 1970s, a new subgenre emerged called blaxploitation. This genre typically, or stereotypically, dealt with urban black culture, usually in lower income and crime-ridden neighborhoods, and featured super cool badasses doing super cool badass things, set to a sweet, funky soundtrack. This genre was epitomized by such films as Superfly, Foxy Brown, and of course, Shaft, who was a mean mother.
Shut your mouth!
I'm just talking about Shaft. Marvel, never accompanied to miss a bandwagon, decided to get on board with their own blaxploitation character in the form of Luke Cage, hero for hire. Luke Cage, originally named Carl Lucas, was a good guy from Harlem, wrongly accused of being a drug dealer, and was sentenced to Seagate Prison, where he was experimented on and given super strength and unbreakable skin. It did not, however, give him any fashion sense. After escaping from prison with his new powers, Luke sets up shop as a hero for hire, but soon finds the ethical dilemmas of being a hero more complicated than he first thought. In this collection, Luke adopts a new moniker, Power Man, wanting to be taken more seriously and thinking this will solve his problem rather than just simply changing out of his yellow blouse, giant chain belt, and tiara. This collection, written and drawn by a rotating group of creators, follow Luke through his battles with, let's go with unique group of villains, his attempts at a love life, and his struggle to keep his apartment in one piece. But more importantly, it follows Luke Cage as he comes to grips with his need to make a living and doing what is right for his community. In the end, it's all about how Luke Cage, Power Man, learns what it means to be a hero and finally figures out who he really is. Brian, what did you think of this collection?
Well, it was a lot of fun, wasn't it? I love this era of Marvel. This was when I was introduced. We've talked about this before, but this is sort of the era of Marvel that I was introduced to comics with in many ways, mostly with the Avengers. Mm-hmm. But the entire sort of 70s run of Marvel fascinates me. It's a lot of fun. It's a lot of goofy, but it's when things started to get like some of the subject matter began to get a little more serious. They did this in the 60s too, but in the 70s where the sort of social consciousness was really starting to take over.
Yeah, there was a lot. There was a lot looser with the creators were given a lot more freedom to do things.
Yes.
Yeah.
And
I'm sorry.
Go ahead. No.
No, I was gonna say I love 70s comics as well. I adore this era. I love its silliness and goofiness, but there was also a ton of experimentation going on. They were, you know, trying out new things. They were
not all of it successful.
Well, yeah. They, like I said, they were exploring social issues and different writing styles, and not everything hit the mark. And sometimes it failed, but it failed spectacularly. And sometimes, you know, failing spectacularly is more interesting than succeeding boringly. That makes sense.
I mean, we got Howard the Duck.
Yes. Oh, wait. I could go on and on about Steve Gerber. But
Yeah,
I know. It's just, I really, really enjoy this era. Because, like I said, even when they fail, it's interesting.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I think Power Man / Luke Cage falls squarely into this idea. And I am not committing to succeeding or failing. because I think Luke Cage is a little bit of both.
Yeah. Well, you know what? It's very... Okay, so I mentioned that there's a rotating group of writers and artists on this. Didn't seem like there was one central idea for where Luke Cage should go.
No, there was not, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it seems really inconsistent in its mood and tone and the message it's trying to get across. Luke's characterization is...
Inconsistent?
Inconsistent. Is he a hothead? Is he a super cool jive hipster? Is he a hopeless romantic? Is he, you know, an altruistic hero? Is he just out for himself? It just, you know, it changes issue to issue. Yeah, none of these characterizations seem to stick or they're not developed in any cohesive way. It's really odd, I think.
Yeah. I think you get the strongest sense of the arcs by Tony Isabella and the arcs by Don McGregor are the strongest.
Yeah, I would say it isn't until Don McGregor comes on that you get a real vision for who Luke Cage is going to be.
And I think Don McGregor's take, which was brief, I believe, and someone could correct me if I'm wrong, the five issue arc that he does in this collection that we're reading was his only writing for Luke Cage. Does that sound correct to you?
Yes. Yes, it is.
Cause I looked him up, but now I can't remember. Well, I looked him up just to see like how much more of Luke Cage he wrote. And I believe I read that this was it, which is really interesting because he brings the street poet.
Right.
Like, McGregor's writing is he wants to be like, he wants to be a noir writer. He wants to be like a hard-boiled crime writer.
Yeah.
And McGregor has like a great history in comics. I mean, his run on Black Panther Jungle Action? Is it Jungle Action or Jungle Fantasy? Jungle
very,
Fantasy
very, is something else. Jungle very unfortunate Action. Name for a comic book.
Yeah, very unfortunate name, but his run on that is considered some of the greatest writing of Black Panther that we've had. But he brings this... that's not the right word. He brings this interesting poetic street poetry to the boxes.
Right. He gives a voice to this comic that was sort of, you know, adrift and voiceless.
And he's kind of breaking the show don't tell. I talk about that a lot, but I think in comics that's especially an interesting idea. You know, he does break the show don't tell because he's describing more than the artist can show.
Right. And, Gaiman does that as well.
Yes.
You know, but it's right after this that, you know, ironically, it's when he's paired up with Iron Fist that both of those characters truly start to become what we think of them now.
Right. The current iteration or a suggestion of the current. I mean, I think Luke Cage has changed way more than Iron Fist has.
Yeah, yeah, yes. Well, that's because of writers like Bendis.
By necessity in some ways, because let's be honest, some of the dialogue.
Well, that gets into the experimentation thing, because these were guys, white guys, we should say, who were, you know, trying different dialects and different ways of using dialogue, trying to make it more street and hip. It doesn't always come across well.
You could argue purity of intention, but
yes,
in execution, it worked at the time because they were, like you said, aping the blaxploitation.
Right, exactly.
Sort of dialogue and films and sort of vernacular of the time, but
yeah, you would not. You can watch an episode of Kojak,
right,
or Beretta, and you're going to get the same kind of dialogue.
You could not get away with that now, unless it was a very specific writer, and with a very specific intent on using some of that.
Yeah.
Some of those linguistics, some of that rhetoric.
Being an homage of sorts to this.
Right.
So, yeah. I mean, you have to understand that these writers, Len Wein, Tony Isabella, who else was there? Engelhart's in there. Yeah. I mean,
George Perez wrote one as well, along with illustrating one.
Yeah. And Buckler is in here, and Buckner is in here. And it's just... Basically, this is a who's who of all the creators at Marvel at this time.
Right. They were basically, if a writer fell behind, they were just slotting in whoever was available to write a fill-in issue, which is an interesting idea in that people get all bunched up these days when you have a fill-in artist or a fill-in writer for a comic.
Right. No, this was just something they did.
As if this is a new thing, and it is offending their very sensibilities that this would happen in comics, that you'd have a fill-in. I was like, well, clearly they were doing this in, like, when did this, is this 1974 to 1976? Are those the years? Right.
Yes, it is.
Yeah. So not a new idea.
I know. Yeah. But I was going to say that these guys were, you know, pretty progressive thinkers for the time, but,
right.
But they are from a generation where the old ways are still there, if you know what I mean.
Yes.
So even though they have the best intentions, the message can come across a little clumsy.
But then again, one has to wonder if it came across as clumsy in the mid 70s as it reads to us now.
You know what? I read these comics back then, or at least a little bit later in the 70s, and I don't remember thinking that, but then I was 8.
Right.
So I don't know. You know, so I don't know. I can't remember if this was seen as offensive or silly, but I kind of think that because there were so many different artists and writers on this, you know, like I said, there wasn't that one centralized voice. So,
right.
But the way Tony Isabella did jive was completely different from the way Len Wein did jive.
Yeah. So, and one could argue that Tony Isabella did it a little bit better.
That's, you know.
Yeah, we're comparing lemons to lemons, but...
I think it's incredibly fun. I mean, I laughed most of my way through these. There are certain things like the hospital that Claire Temple works at is the ghetto clinic. Is that really why...
is that the name of it?
Yeah, they called it the ghetto clinic.
The ghetto clinic.
Really? Okay. Yes, I mean, so there's some things that come across as maybe a little tone deaf. So, you know, and we'll get into specifics in a second here, but I want to talk about some of the things that are, you know, like we said, the message is a little muddy, but that, you know, they were trying to go for racial issues and more socially inclusive messages. And
the attempt was honorable.
Yes, absolutely. They really were trying to do the best they could. Right. And the message they were trying to get across is one that's admirable. You know, A for effort. I'm okay with that.
And they even managed to work in Black Power. Well, no, it was the origin of Power Man was Luke Cage is fighting somebody, and they made some kind of derogatory comment about him being black, and he responded with, feel my black power. And then he was like, because this is when he was trying to figure out a name, and he was, and then he, in the thought bubbles, he was like, so he said Black Power, and then he was like, and then he worked through it, and he was like, Power Man.
Yeah,
and
well, then, it wasn't just that. He said, Black Power, comma, man. Feel my Black Power, man.
Yeah.
Yes, that fight with Iron Man was a bit, wow. It was a bit silly.
Well, it's... it was so that's the first issue of this series is Luke Cage gets tricked into attacking some Tony Stark factory to steal something.
He's supposed to be testing Tony Stark's security by trying to break in and steal it.
And
what he's really doing is distracting Iron Man so that the real thief can come in and steal his experimental suit.
Which, and of course, leads to an entire issue of ye old superheroes fight, superheroes team up.
Yep, they fight for a bit and then they're pals.
Yes.
And this is the first of many issues where Luke Cage throws someone off a tall building and or out of a plane. Yeah.
There is a lot of being thrown over buildings. Yeah. Not just Luke Cage throwing people. He gets thrown over buildings.
Yeah. People fall from tall heights quite a bit.
Constantly. It seems... Well, it's, apparently that's one of the only ways to hurt him.
Well, there's a couple of villains who fall off of buildings and just as Luke Cage go, yeah, okay, well, I guess that's it then. Time for me to go home.
Well, that happened. Yeah. And of course, you can't call the cops because he's on the run from the cops. So I guess he doesn't kill them.
Not necessarily.
Right. It's the old, they killed themselves due to their momentum.
I threw you into that beam and who knew that beam was going to break?
Right.
Yeah.
Batman, of course, Batman gets away with that all the time. Batman doesn't kill. It's just that people end up dying when they fight Batman by accident.
But what I find really funny when he first gets his name, he calls himself Power Man, tells Iron Man, I'm Power Man, that's what you can call me, goes home, and then immediately has someone attack him calling him Power Man. That got around really quick.
Yeah. Well, and it's amazing. Like when he goes to there's the arc where he goes to California and everybody there knows about him. Now, as far as I can tell, only maybe a week or two have gone by. I think this entire arc takes up 2 weeks?
Yeah, easily.
And yet he goes to California, and when he runs into people out there, they're like, oh, that's the, people in California are like, oh, that's that New York superhero Power Man.
Yeah, these got around quickly.
It's like, wow, how'd they hear about him?
He's got a publicist.
Because he complains through the whole series that nobody knows who he is. But yet everybody seems to know who he is.
It's one of the ironies of being Power Man,
I guess.
Yeah. Before we get into more specifics about the issues, I want to talk about, there's a fascinating editorial voice that runs through, especially the earlier.
Especially Roy Thomas, I think.
Roy Thomas. I was going to say, yes, Roy Thomas. I mean, it's not uncommon in this era to have the editor and the writers treat the reader like they're part of the creation.
Right.
It's like an extension. It's Stan Lee's voice from the 60s. It's kind of an extension of that. And the reader is treated like an insider.
Yes.
All the artists and writers are assumed to be known, and we're given little winks and nods and asides. Like we're part of the family. Like we're on the inside.
Yeah.
But Roy Thomas gets a little bitchy. There's one there's one issue where there's a couple of splash pages, and the editor's note in one, I wrote this down, this is what's known in the industry as terse writing. That's a little passive aggressive right there. But then the next one says, this is what's known in the industry as a lazy writer trying to get away with murder. I was floored by that. I mean, wow. Were you having a bad day, Roy? Jeez.
But I mean, how much of that is a joke? And how much of that is the writer in on the joke?
I don't know. I mean, it was because almost splash, like...
Because splash pages are very much and have been the bread and butter for comics for a long time. And even at that time, a splash page is... That's the chance to allow the artist to basically create their next, their portfolio, to create their Comic-Con piece that they're going to sell or what have you.
Yeah. Liefeld was famous for that in the 90s. Basically just writing entire issues of splash pages.
Yeah.
But the use of lazy writer, I mean, that's like we're witnessing a spat.
Right.
You know, Because I don't know. I just thought, man, Roy, give the guy a break. It's actually a pretty cool splash page.
But that it could even get past the editor, because other eyes look at it than more than just the editor, that it could get past the editor and go to print suggests to me that there may be a little more nudge, nudge, wink, wink than animosity. But who knows?
I hope so, because I mean, but the tone came across as just mean to me.
I think Roy Thomas was known to be a tad on the prickly side in general, though.
Yeah, prickly. Shorten that a bit.
Persnickety.
But yeah, I just thought that was very interesting. And but I do, you know, overall though, I do like the back and forth that the editor's notes, not just Roy Thomas, but also Len Wein when he became the editor. I love that sort of bringing you in, talking directly to the reader.
Right.
You remember that from last issue, right? That sort of thing.
Yeah. And also in some of the dialogue boxes, the writer refers to, in this case, himself. They're all males. The writer refers to himself and the artist. Like, welcome back. You know, here's what Tony Isabella and... Here's what Isabella and Truska have brought to you to this week or this month. And there's a lot of that sort of inside Marvel or inside Marvel Comics humor that is even done within the dialogue or the dialogue boxes of the plotting itself, which I've always found that interesting about Marvel.
Yeah. It's a fascinating, it's very inclusive. I remember that distinctly growing up and reading Marvel comics. And, you know, I felt like I knew all these people.
Yeah.
They were giving me a little inside, giving me a little nudge to say, yeah, you remember that, right? You were there for that.
And I think Jason Aaron is using that a little bit. I don't know if you've read any of the new Avengers comic that Jason Aaron is doing.
I've just read the first issue, but.
Yeah, but he's got a little bit of that self-referential thing going on in it, which I find pretty amusing. And it's funny because I was reading those first few of the new Avengers at the same time I was reading these Luke Cage arcs, and I was like, hey, that sounds familiar.
Yeah, that's great. Let's talk about, first of all, there's as haphazard as these issues are, you know, issue by issue, each one is, if you take one as single issues, they're really fun stories. Putting them together, there's not really a coherent whole, but there are some through line stories. The fact that, you know, Luke Cage is on the run. He's changed his name. He's not really hiding.
No, that's the other part that gets me. He doesn't want the cops to find him because they'll know who he is, but he's kind of, you know, he has a business card.
Yes.
And he's out there and complaining that he doesn't get enough media coverage.
Yeah, I mean, it's not like he changed his face or anything like that.
Nope.
He's not even wearing a little domino mask or anything like that. I guess detectives weren't the same back then, because they're not really putting two and two together.
No, doesn't seem like it. I mean, the closest we get is Quentin Chase.
And I think Quentin Chase is on his side, so it's all good. So there's that, and then there's the love interest or the love story between Claire Temple and Luke. That's a nice little through line story. There's not much else. There's no real big stakes going on here.
Not really. I mean, we do get a little bit of it again towards the end.
Yes. Like I said, you know, when McGregor comes on, I think everything starts to coalesce and it finds its feet and knows where it's going to go. It just takes a long time to get there. Yeah. But along the way, there's some really great things. Like, for instance, a man with a mace on his hand. Named Mace.
His name is Gideon Mace.
Yeah.
That's one of my favorite moments because, you know, of course it's because it's Marvel and it's the 70s, so they over-explain everything.
Yes.
The villain always has to go into a long diatribe and monologue. He was talking about how he survived drowning.
Yeah.
And so he's telling the backstory of, like, because apparently, you know, Luke Cage had, like, thrown him into the ocean one time. And so he's like, you thought I would drown with this mace tied around my, or this mace attached to my arm. So you thought that would just cause me to drown, right? And he said, Well, the joke's on you because the mace is detachable. So I removed the mace from my arm and then swam up to the surface carrying the mace.
Yeah, which makes no sense at all. To be fair, I've read that story where Luke throws him into the water and he says, "Oh no, it's grafted to my arm. I'll sink." So that's how that story ends. And then he comes back. "I was just kidding. It wasn't grafted to my arm. I can unscrew it." And then
but he unscrewed it and then swam to the surface carrying it.
If you could do that, just swim to the surface without unscrewing.
I know.
Let's just say Luke Cage's Rogues Gallery is less than satisfying.
Yeah, I got what do you got? Steeplejack, Cottonmouth.
Well, there's Discus
and Discus
and Stiletto.
And Stiletto, right.
There's the
Cockroach, Piranha.
Piranha Jones.
Piranha Jones.
Yeah. The Circus of Crime.
Circus of Crime.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I gotta say, hold on. When they introduce, because they have to go through the Circus of Crime and they introduce who all the members are and give you their powers before you fight, because you gotta do
right.
that. When it gets to the clown, it says, "He's silent, but no less deadly." So the clown is a fart.
which, you know, the writer
he was had to have having known.
A time there.
He had to have known. Okay, and of course, my personal favorite, Mr. Fish.
Oh, yeah.
So Mr. Fish, when he's finally beaten, he jumps at Luke Cage, who ducks. And then as Mr. Fish flies over top of him, falling to his death, he shouts, "No, you weren't supposed to move." There's a flaw in his plan.
And he fell to Pisces on the ground below him.
Yes, he did. Bravo, sir.
Yeah, Mr. Yeah, there are so many great. I think some of these stories are really great, and we're obviously joking about some of the more humorous aspects of which all comics in that time period shared.
Oh yeah,
but there are some really great comics in here. But I have to say, the Mr. Fish episode issue and the Night Shocker vampire issue were probably, to me, those were like the ones that I could barely get through.
The Night Stalker Shocker.
Yeah, Night what? Shocker. What is first a Night
all, Shocker? First of all, they try, because there's a Night Stalker, and they mentioned that in the beginning. Because mm-hmm. that was, you know, TV.
That's the show, yeah.
Yeah. Because it was Engelhart who wrote that issue. Mm-hmm. Did he write for Night Stalker?
I don't know. That's a good question.
I find it really odd that they tried to tie those two things together. But I thought that was a really good issue up until you get the reveal at the end that I was just pretending to be a vampire.
And they removed the mask and I was waiting for it. I would have gotten away with it if it weren't for you meddling kids.
Exactly. It was a very Scooby-Doo ending. But of course, Luke Cage was like, "I wasn't fooled at all. You were wearing the wrong shoes."
Because up to that point, Luke Cage has shown great detecting skills. Then suddenly he's able to determine shoe prints.
Well, and shoe color, and you know, I can.
Yeah. But you know what? It's fun.
It is. It's incredibly fun. Now, even the circus ones, the circus issues are really fun. Because you have Goliath, you know, everybody's hypnotized because everybody got hypnotized in the 70s. And I love the fact that who was the snake woman?
I forget her name.
But she had to say.
I forget all their names.
Yes, but she had to say, "I had that unfortunate time when I was part of the Serpent Society." And then they give a little flashback to a Captain right. America.
Everybody stops fighting.
Hold on. I got to give you my backstory. Okay.
Any person could get their backstory.
And I do love the fact that, you know, Marvel had enough continuity in mind that they did remember that there was another guy named Power Man.
Right.
Who had to come in so that Luke could have a nice big fight with this guy so that who gets to have the moniker Power Man.
The winner keeps the name.
Winner keeps the name, of course. I do want that movie theater to exist, though. Plays nothing but classic westerns.
Yeah, it's a great, except they keep destroying it.
Yeah, that's sort of a running joke as well.
Yeah.
You know, that, his that office.
And keep, machine, that and the coffee or soda machine that doesn't work.
The soda machine is brilliant, I think, because it's always something different. You know, the order of the soda coming out.
Where it's, right.
You know, ice, then soda, then cup. Or then the cup comes up, but it's upside down.
And the fact that it never works, but yet Luke Cage continually puts his money in it.
As silly as all this is, and it is silly, like we were saying, there are some pretty interesting social issues that they're trying to bring across. The one, it's actually the Gideon Mace, where they have the security city.
Right.
Which is basically just a concentration camp. But this kind of reminds me of something, but I can't think of it, where people are fed a certain story and they begin to believe it.
Huh.
Yeah.
That sounds familiar.
And then they try to isolate themselves and exclude people who aren't like them.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, vaguely familiar.
Any news or anything that doesn't fit into their narrative is condemned as being fake.
Yeah.
True, right?
Yeah, exactly. You know, and like I said, I don't know exactly what this reminds me of.
Yeah.
But it's interesting.
No one would ever use that in real life.
Never. The only difference I can see is that when Gideon Mace is heard saying terrible things, people immediately turn against him.
Which would be a natural reaction, right? Yeah. I mean, when you hear Gideon Mace, like if I were in that situation and I heard Gideon Mace confessing to all of the evil plans that he had, you know, I would be like those people in that compound and be like, oh, he's been pulling the wool over our eyes all this time.
Yeah.
And I would be upset and would react accordingly, I believe.
Yeah. I would think that would be the case as well.
Yeah. Which I think is, you know, I mean that if something like that ever happened in real life, I think we could reasonably expect that, you know, that humanity would also react in the same way.
Right. Yeah. But that could never happen in real life.
Right, which is why this is comics and not reflective of real life in any way, shape, or form.
End scene. There's a very anti-capitalist strain running through this whole thing, throughout all the writers.
Despite Luke Cage wanting to make lots of money.
Well, yeah. And that in itself, that's actually my favorite part of this, is the fact that that idea hadn't really been touched on in comics up to this point, which is, you know, someone's got to make a living.
Right. You know, not everybody is a millionaire or billionaire industrialist.
Yeah. You sort of get that with Spider-Man, but he's always, you know, but he has a job.
Right.
He's a photographer.
But he's always poor because, you know, he has spends half his time or more as Spider-Man and not doing his job. And even his job doesn't pay that well.
Exactly. So you got Luke Cage, who wants to use his power to make some money.
Right.
But at the same time, do what's right. And I love the dichotomy of that, because he's never really making any money, because he always stops to do the right thing, basically.
Right.
And doing the right thing is not going to get him paid.
And even if he does end up making the money, then he has to pay for whatever damage he's done.
That office of his just gets crushed.
Yeah. Well, and then they keep raising the rent on his poor office.
I know. $44 a month? Highway robbery.
In New York City. Well, you know, it's those New York City rates.
Yep. There's one issue where it mentions, I think, 5 or 6 times that it's gone up to 72.9 cents a gallon.
Right.
For gas.
Which actually I think was expensive, which was indeed expensive for the time if you take into account inflation, but this is when the oil crisis was going on.
Right. But it's almost like the writer was just pissed. 72. Yeah. Oh man. He just kept mentioning it over and over again.
And they mentioned taxes a lot too.
Yes.
There's a lot of references about property tax and a couple other taxes, but yeah, like almost every issue has someone complaining about New York taxes.
That was, and I do remember that being a big deal in the 70s that taxes went up, but services went down.
Again, not like real life. Yeah,
exactly. That was a different time.
I also like, I feel like we're having a Chris Farley. Remember that time when you did the thing and the,
yeah.
But again, for like through lines, kind of going back to your through lines, I think every issue at some point he mentions like being a hero for hire, which is key in keeping what you were just saying. But the fact that it's mentioned, it's presaged throughout like all of like these issues. I don't think they were planning on Heroes for Hire as a comic book at this point.
No, it actually, that's what originally it was Luke Cage Hero for Hire. And then it was changed to Power Man, Luke Cage Power Man. So he was originally, that was his deal. He was going to be the
Luke Cage Hero for Hire.
Hero for Hire.
Okay.
But it never really worked out because, like I said, he always ended up saving the little guy and not helping his corporate masters, you know, which is an interesting subject for a superhero. I wish I was touched on more now because, you know, if I had superpowers, I'd want to maybe make a buck off of it as well as helping the world.
Especially if you don't have a job, you know. How do you pay for your suit?
And I do love the fact that it's referenced that, you know, he keeps his blouse keeps getting torn up. He said, these things aren't cheap, you know.
Which is a running joke even to this day.
Yes. Even in the television series. That outfit. Come on, we got to address
I think it looks great.
the man's wearing a tiara all the time. He never takes it off.
Oh, he takes it off once in a while. They're like, no. They're seeing when he's in his civilian, when he's in his civvy clothes, he doesn't have the tiara.
How many times is he in his civilian clothes?
There's numerous, there's a few moments, you know, when he's at the gravesite. He's at a gravesite at some point.
Yeah, that's true. That is true. Yeah. I'll give you that.
Where he's wearing just regular clothes or regular 70s looking clothes. But, I mean, the costume is very much of its time. It's just jeans and a yellow shirt.
And a giant chain link belt.
Yeah, but you know that goes back to Isaac Hayes. So you know, I mean, he's just.
Did Isaac Hayes wear a giant chain link belt?
I don't know. Sure, he's got that big chain. What is it? Hot Buttered Soul. Does he have that big chain around his neck? No, I think that's like that type of thing is consistent with sort of the blaxploitation images that were going on. Maybe someone wasn't specifically wearing a chain around. As a belt, but okay. I think it is keeping with the sort of political nature of the blaxploitation. Okay. I think the chain is representing something a little more than just keeping his pants up.
Yes, I do understand the symbolism.
Plus, it could come in handy at some point as well.
Like if he needed to lock up his bike.
Right, sure, yeah. Because he can't afford a car.
No, I love the fact that he has to take a cab to all the...
Or he takes the subway. Yeah. I must go fight crime. I'm going to hop on the subway.
All right, I do want to talk about the character of Cockroach real quick.
Okay.
I think is actually a pretty good villain for Luke Cage.
I do like Cockroach.
Yeah. A six-barreled shotgun is really interesting to have as a weapon, especially one named Josh.
Yeah, when you name your gun...
Well, he lives with his gun in an apartment full of cockroaches, and he only eats cheese nips.
Cheese, yeah. Or what are they called? They're not cheese nips, but they're like a cheese nip substitute.
Yeah.
And the cockroaches live in the cheese nips as well. It doesn't sound right for some. I mean, besides the obvious. Grammatically, I'm not sure how that works. You can do some deep structure on that. He doesn't seem bothered by that. He asks the cockroaches to get out of his bag of cheese nips, and they follow his orders, and then he proceeds to eat them. The cheese nips, not the cockroaches.
Yeah, it's very disturbing. Now, I honestly do think he was an interesting villain.
Well, it's not only that he's got an interesting look, and it's that it's the sort of hyper-exaggerated facial features.
Yeah, like a sort of a Ralph Bakshi kind of a cartoon. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, of course he's small You know, and just with the trench coat and all of that, yeah, he's got a, it's a really interesting look. It's a good look, and he is an interesting. He's much more interesting than Piranha Jones.
Oh yeah,
actually, he's probably the most interesting of all the characters. Maybe save X, the Willie Dance, who of course was the tragic character in all of this. But
yeah, that was a very sad story.
It was a sad story, but you know, not to give too much away, but
I think we can spoil a 40-year-old comic.
Well, that's true.
Yeah, and it's even if you know the outcome, it's the journey when you're reading these comics.
Yeah, I mean, you know, X is the washed up wrestler, and his agent gets a hold of a serum, as happens in comics, that changes him and gives him superpowers.
It's that old Captain America super soldier serum that just somehow it can't be replicated, and yet it is replicated all the time.
Yeah, it's replicated all the time, right. And so he gets a hold of this and then kind of turns into a bad guy briefly. But he's not really a bad guy because he's not really the brightest.
He's a child having a temper tantrum.
Right. And, of course, he ends up his actions end up getting his manager, who's been basically caretaking him, and gets him killed. And it's just, you know, and of course, everybody has sads.
Yeah, it's very tragic.
Yeah, it's one of the more affecting stories with it. It's probably the most affecting story in this arc, and I recommend it. It's a tad on the heavy-handed side, but everything
is heavy-handed.
So yeah. Take that with a grain of salt and enjoy the story for what it is. But but it's hard to even think of him as a villain, although technically he is. But yeah, he and Cockroach are, I think, my two favorite, certainly more than, I think Piranha Jones, he has sharp teeth.
Yeah, and it says over and over again that he can't break Luke's skin, and yet keeps trying to.
Well, everybody keeps trying to shoot Luke Cage, even though they know that it doesn't work. And I think my favorite is when Luke Cage is afraid of being dumped into the pool with all the piranhas.
Yeah.
Why?
Yeah, why?
Why would he, you know, why? He's like, I'm going to get eaten.
No, you're not.
Not bloody likely. But again, it's, you know.
Yeah, you have to have some kind of tension there.
And then one of the best parts, I thought, was, you know, was it Cockroach who figured out maybe the way to kill Luke Cage was when they tied him to the bridge?
Yes. Yes, it was Cockroach who did that. And yeah, it's very reminiscent of the Spider-Man lifting the beam.
It's a drawbridge.
It's a drawbridge that's opening with him.
They tie him in the middle of it, so it would basically snap him and break him in half. You're assuming that the mechanics of the drawbridge, this massive thing, would be enough to snap Luke Cage in half, and it leads to like quite a dramatic scene. And like you said, it is reminiscent of the Spider-Man trapped underground and lifting
the famous Ditko panels where he's trying to lift the panels or lift the beams over him. Right. But this is, you know, the bridge is opening and he's being pulled apart and he has to summon all his strength to unchain himself.
And I thought that was it was a great example of that. That's kind of an example of the Luke Cage that we have kind of like come to know and love, like the willpower and the use of his strength in a superhuman form rather than just, you know, beating up on people.
And you see his, not necessarily his vulnerability, but his humanity. Yeah. That scene was incredibly well done. And I do like the fact that when he finally does free himself, he just happens to fall on the tugboat all the way down through all the floors. Cause he is 300 pounds.
Right. And why would there not be a tugboat underneath him?
Yes. Well, that is why the bridge was opening for the tugboat.
For the tugboat, which the tugboat also, was it actually tall enough that it needed the drawbridge?
I thought that myself. I thought the tugboat could just slip underneath there.
Because he fell a long way. And it was just a tugboat. It wasn't like a ship.
Right. Maybe they were just being extra cautious.
Right. Yes. You know, you don't want to take chances on these things. Yeah. We talk about this like in some of the humorous bits and stuff, but I think at the end of the day, and this was a great recommendation, Paul, because it's a lot of fun. And, you know, even the silly stuff that we're pointing out, which it is, but it's no sillier than any other comic book from that time period. And at the end of the day, that's why we started reading, most of us, at least our age, that's why we started reading comics, was these were the type of stories that we loved as kids. And we still had a sense of wonder. And we were certainly not as cynical as we are now. And so reading these, it was amazing. I mean, you were watching basically an African-American superhero on the streets of New York who was fighting like these crazy, wacky villains. We didn't think they were wacky at the time. Some of them were probably scary.
And, you know, and like I said, there's, you know, for all its clumsiness, there is a lot of social commentary going on because he is, you know, he's from an underprivileged area, and he's always, and the villains are always, you know, people at the top sitting in a penthouse.
Yes.
You know, that's saying a lot about the society at the time. Also, you know, and you're absolutely, everything you just said is correct. And I agree with you 100%, but there's also the added benefit of looking in hindsight, looking back on it and seeing how a new character grew and developed. And, you know, cause I think Luke Cage started as an idea, but didn't really have a direction.
Right. Not a well-formed idea.
Right. And it was, at the time. It's really fascinating, you know, to watch that grow and take shape. And so many different creators jumped in there to layer on different ideas. You don't really get that anymore.
No, I mean,
you get a new character, but if it doesn't take off immediately, it's gone.
It's canceled in 6 issues.
Right.
And some of that's not the publisher's fault. Some of that is the fickle fans of fate.
Or the...
I like that. Yeah. The fickle fans of fate. You know, it goes back to my Batman issue. Or my issue with the...
Your issue with the issue.
My issue with the issue is... Some fanboys probably love that because Batman cannot change ever. He must always be Bruce Wayne and must always be solitary and must always be this, that, and the other. And it's like, you know, these are the same people who then will never give a new character a chance because that's not what I grew up with. Or, you know, that character shouldn't be a woman, or that character shouldn't be a person of color, or that person shouldn't be a member of the LGBTQ community. You know, I only want my straight, white, male superheroes. And, you know, that's why characters can't take off now.
And it's just not as interesting, you know. But overall, I can't say enough about 70s comics. It's just, it's near and dear to my heart. Not just Luke Cage, but that whole, there's so much goodness in the 70s.
Yeah.
It's silly. It's weird. It's goofy, but it's also very experimental and different. And creators were trying new things that eventually became the writing that we see later in the 80s and 90s. I mean, it started here. People just trying different styles, both artistically and linguistically.
Yeah.
I love this stuff. Everyone should go out and read some old Power Man comics.
Agreed.
So I think that should be it for this episode. Brian, what are we going to do next time?
Oh, next time we're going to continue with Comics Should Be Fun. So for my recommendation next time, we are going to dip our toes back into the Golden Age, and we are going to read the legendary Carl Banks's Uncle Scrooge. And the collection I selected for our next podcast is going to be part of the Fantagraphics reprint series that they did of Carl Banks' work on sort of the whole Donald Duck, Uncle Scrooge world that Carl Banks wrote and drew extensively. And so we're going to do Walt Disney's Uncle Scrooge, Volume 14, The Seven Cities of Gold, which also features a scene that was directly lifted by one Mr. Steven Spielberg for one of his films.
Really? That's interesting.
Yes. So, again, for next time, it's going to be Carl Banks's run on Uncle Scrooge. Well, he created Uncle Scrooge, actually.
Oh, see, didn't know that. I don't know a lot of the lore of Uncle Scrooge.
Well, see, you know, this is your history, son. Mm.
Can I sing? Woohoo!
You can.
Okay. So no, I have not read any Uncle Scrooge comics, so this will be a brand new adventure for me.
You've never read any?
None.
Wow. See, that was a gateway comic for most of most kids growing up was, you know, those Gold Key Uncle Scrooge comics.
I guess I missed out as a kid.
And Carl Banks, virtually every comics illustrator worth his or her salt, would cite Carl Banks as an influence, no less.
Yeah. Well, I know the name, and I've seen the panels. I just haven't actually sat down and read any of the stories. So this is an education for me.
We are going to read 240 pages of Uncle Scrooge stories for next time.
Okay.
Again, the Fantagraphics reissue, volume 14, The Seven Cities of Gold.
All right. Well, I look forward to that.
Prepare for fun.
Prepare for fun. So, okay, thanks everybody for listening. Please go to our website, collectededitionpodcast.com, and leave comments on our individual episodes, or send us your feedback at comments@collectededitionpodcast.com, or leave us a review on iTunes. That would be awesome if you did that. And other than that, I guess we'll see you next time.
We will indeed.
All right. So till next time, keep reading comics.
And be well.
You've been listening to The Collected Edition, a comic book podcast. The Collected Edition is a Daddy Elk production. All materials used on the show are copyright their respective copyright holders, and no infringement is intended. The show can be found on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play, as well as online at collectededitionpodcast.com, where comments can be left on individual episodes. You can also send us feedback at comments@collectededitionpodcast.com or on Twitter @collectededpod. That's collected, EDPOD. The Collected Edition, a comic book podcast, is for entertainment purposes only.
Are you not entertained? Are you not entertained?
Because my brain is cottage Swiss cheese. It's cottage cheese as well. It's yes. Cottage cheese made out of Swiss cheese.
That doesn't sound very Gouda.
Oh!
Did you hear about the guy who brought his gun to a cheese shop? He just wanted to shoot the breeze. Whoa. Hello. I can't bear it anymore.
You have more. Get him out of here.
I'm good.
Let's work through it.
No, I'm good.
Real quick, I don't know. We were in the middle of it, so I didn't want to stop us. But at some point, the neighbors above me were vacuuming.
I heard something in the background.
Yeah, and then at some point, my other neighbors who have the 1.5-year-old child, but at the same time, they were coming home, and my windows are open, and she was having an upset time.
Yeah. So you know what? I didn't know if that was a cat or something. It was something in the background, and I was like, I wonder if that's a cat. I'll try to muffle that, and if it doesn't, you know what? Screw it.
It's just part of the character. Yeah. You can just say, hey, Brian lives in Chicago in a neighborhood, and so, you know, he lives with many, many, many people, and he has his windows open, and the life that is Chicago bleeds into his home.
To dream the impossible dream, to fight the unbeatable foe, to bear with unbearable sorrow, to run where the brave dare not go. Right, the unrightable wrong, to love pure and chaste from afar, to try when your arms are too weary, to reach the unreachable sun.
Shazam!